how it ended up in Cleveland actually goes to the Cleveland that with the national air races that were held in Cleveland from 1929 to 1949. And it was at the what's now known as Cleveland-Hopkins International Airport. And so there's an idea in terms of how to do that, and some of the criteria that they're looking for was an educated workforce, access to an airfield, and in terms of power and those types of things. And going back there, the kind of the running was between Chicago and Cleveland. And you may not realize it, but back at that time, Cleveland was actually, at various points in history, the number one manufacturer kind of back and forth with Detroit in terms of autos. So a lot of engines and mechanical engineering and those kinds of expertise. But when it came down to the decision, kind of like you hear a lot in terms of politics and those types of things, whether it's usually it's hearing about building stadiums or all that kind of stuff, but you know, kind of sweetening the pot a little bit, and Cleveland was able to offer about a 50% discount on the power. And you think about these massive wind tunnels and the way that type of power that they draw, it was a major impact on the budget. And we were able to offer in Cleveland a 50% discount on electricity rates. That was a strong selling point that helped push it along with some of the other factors. So this is actually what the air races looked like in 1938. And what you're seeing is the actual, that kind of the letter shape D and those black lines are the parking lot for the air races. They had a permanent grandstand that could seat 500 people, and the likes of Jimmy Doolittle, Amelia Earhart, if you had a name in aviation, this was the place to be. And many of them flew there, and as many of you probably realize, when we say air races, they literally were air races flying around pylons and those types of things. And so now you can see George Lewis, as we mentioned earlier, looking at an architectural model of what the Aircraft Engine Research Laboratory looked like as they started construction. Ground was broke on January 23rd of 1941 and was coming online. And you can see that telltale D shape again. And you can see it here from a kind of a overhead model view. You can see that real shape again. That's, we still hold that shape today. If you come out, if you fly over in and out of Hopkins Airport, you can see that. And so like I said, the city of Cleveland lobbied real hard to get that. And you can, we're certainly pleased, and now we're coming up, we're celebrating 74 years. Next year we'll be celebrating our 75th anniversary. Now this is some of the construction that started in 1942. This was a steam plant, needed steam for research, but also, you know, oftentimes people look at the budgets and you compare centers, and we're the only center north of the Mason-Dixon line, so we also need steam to keep us warm. And sometimes that's real important and a good 6 months of the year. And then in terms of research facilities, this is the engine propeller research building as it was being coming online in 1942, and what we call the prop test house. This is a look inside as we opened up for business. On the left side, you see an interior view of a drafting room in the engine research building. And it's just, you know, kind of fascinating to see all those guys sitting there at drafting boards and designing things. And to think that all this research, you know, we're so used to, especially if you're, you know, a younger person in the audience, you have, you know, your iPads and your laptops and tablets and different things. And Bill and I were joking around about, you know, in our early years in college, having to use punch cards on computer. This is way before all that. This is slide rules and hand calculations, and to do all this kind of incredible engineering that now we do with computational fluid dynamics and 3D visualization, all those types of things. It really is just amazing. And on the right side, you can see an Allison engine, the V1710, which is a multi-cylinder dynamometer test, and in operation again, also at the engine research building. And it's a building that still bears that name and still keeps running to this day. Initiation of research, we did a ceremony for that in 1942 at the Engine Propeller Research Building. So what happened when we formed the AERL is the folks who were doing that kind of work at Langley, most of them were transferred up to Cleveland into the AERL to be doing work on there, to concentrate that and not be competing back and forth with each other. And so we're working. And a lot of the key things we're looking at is technology associated with liquid-cooled engines versus air-cooled engines. And the two big players at that time were the Wright Aeronautical Company and then Pratt & Whitney. They were bitter rivals, and there was a lot of commercial development. And it's kind of interesting hearing, you know, reading through some of these histories and seeing these types of things. It's kind of history repeating itself. You know, the reason people say, well, why do we need NASA? We've got all these other companies and doing that. And it all often boils down to companies trying to be, you know, protective of their intellectual investments, and then not, you know, having to answer to shareholders. And, you know, we try to get too far out, and people want to know, what's the bottom line? What's my dividend going to be next quarter? Those types of things. And that's part of the value of government research, to do some of those higher risk types of things and get involved. But we do it not independent of, but working with the engine companies and doing the research that way. But Wright and Pratt & Whitney were both primarily focused on the air-cooled engines, and they hadn't taken a whole lot of interest in liquid cooling. And so that's when work started a little bit more with Allison as well, because the advantages of that were being seen. And although the Allison engine, you know, was kind of comparable to some liquid-cooled engines, like, for example, on the British Merlin, but the fighter aircraft, it wasn't is performing as well as the British ones or even the air-cooled ones by Wright and Pratt and Whitney. But the work was designed to help improve that. So May 20th, 1943 is when we actually held the official dedication ceremonies of the Aircraft Engine Research Laboratory in Cleveland. Some of the dignitaries included Orville Wright. You can see his head highlighted there. He actually served NACA for 28 years. And and it's, you know, a little twist there, of course, you know, the Wright brothers had lobbied to have the AERL in Dayton. And obviously, you know, Cleveland won out, which we're very glad, but it worked out well in the long run, because now Dayton's the home of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And again, a lot of their research there, it's a very research-oriented location, and is dedicated towards aircraft propulsion as well. So over the years, we have a great partnership with Wright-Patterson, and in terms of exchanging technology and information and trying to advance the state of the art. Thinking. Sorry about that. Here we go. All right. So now the key thing, obviously you want to test engines and as much as you can on prop stands, doing those types of things, especially as you're making more than a tweak, you know, something just minor incremental, you know, that's, you know, it's not a big deal. But you want to really try to change the nature of an engine, how it performs. You want to make sure it works really well on a test stand before you're putting a pilot and other engineers at risk. But eventually, to prove technology, in-flight research is what is key. And over their history, each of the aeronautics centers that were part of NACA had some component of in-flight research, and we're certainly proud of the heritage we have at NASA Glenn over the years. So this first image is of a Republic P-47 Thunderbolt, a very powerful pursuit aircraft, and it was powered by Pratt & Whitney air-cooled radial R2800-57 engine and a turbocharger. And it was a Whitney flight test was used for that. And then here shows the AER crew with a B-26 Marauder medium-range bomber. And another thing you note on this, if you look at these aircraft, you're not going to see, especially in early years, you know, Bill talked about the budgets. So we weren't out buying aircraft and doing that. We were getting them on loan from the Army Air Corps and eventually the Air Force. Only in the later years did you actually start seeing NACA markings on aircraft. And the key thing, obviously, pilots, you know, I'm sure many pilots in the audience get a lot of the glamour and the glory, but when you're talking about research, it's the pilots certainly up front in the cockpit, but it's the research engineers in the back conducting the data. And again, this is without handheld data recorders, those types of things. It's, you know, you see large boxes and wires and, you know, and even in this case, you know, wearing the, you know, nice warm jacket to keep yourself, you know, warm while you're, you know, you're back there. What was probably originally designed as a cargo hold, not in the comfort of a passenger seat, especially when you're talking to smaller aircraft. And then this is a look inside of the hangar in that time frame in the 1940s. And that's the hangar that's still standing today. Doesn't look all that much different when you come inside. And I'll use that as a mention in terms of coming inside. As we celebrate our 75th anniversary, we are planning to have an open house. It's looking like it's going to be one of the middle weekend in May. So if you're following us on Facebook or Twitter or visiting our websites, you'll be seeing some information. So consider this, please, your invitation to join us May of 2016 as we celebrate our 75th anniversary. And we'll take you inside the hangar and show you and inside vast facilities, our wind tunnels, zero gravity research facilities, a bunch of great places. This is kind of a little anecdotal thing that we found at a job posting ad for, you know, being in a flying laboratory. And if you look at it, it talks about some of the advantages and things of being in the job. And one of the things it talks about is freedom from monotony. And I know many of us in our jobs appreciate the freedom of monotony. But it was kind of an interesting thing. But we're always throughout the history of NACA, and as we still do today, looking for the best and brightest to come and join us and be a part of the research thing. And as I and here and talking to a lot of young students, college, high school students, one of the things that drew me as a young engineer coming to NASA was the opportunity to be involved with research without having a PhD. You could get in there and be involved. And we do have folks with masters and PhDs, but we're not a bunch of people walk around showing our badges and calling each other, doctor or titles and all. It's a team working together, working hand in hand with our technicians and our mechanics to get the research done. And it really is a great opportunity to do that. So if you are a young person in the audience considering a career in those fields, certainly recommend an opportunity to do things with us in NASA these days. But man, we still freedom from monotony. And of course, over the years, we hosted our series of dignitaries. This is July 7th, 1943, and you'll probably recognize this B-17 as the Memphis Belle. It made a stop and came through, and that's certainly a great thing to be a part of, and to kind of reinforce the troops in terms of who we're working, seeing the benefit of the research and how it comes together, and certainly celebrating our patriotism that way. One of the premier facilities that we had developed in that time in 1943 was the altitude wind tunnel. Wind tunnels are a key component to the research that we do, and as Bill mentioned, we were building them at each of our facilities, and our primary one was the altitude wind tunnel. And the key thing, of course, is to be able to test an engine in conditions that it's going to experience in flight. So not only the wind speed, creating the wind tunnel, having the wind flow by it, but creating the atmospheric conditions in terms of the pressure, the humidity, those types of things to do that. So the altitude wind tunnel was a key to being able to do that. And here's one of the engines being tested in there. And then this is the backlight. Of course, to generate all that wind, you need a large fan to generate that and to circulate. There. Now, one of the challenges with this is to create those proper conditions. As you know, especially as pilots, but as you go up in altitude, the temperatures come way down. And while it's not big a challenge for us in the wintertime, we want to be able to run our tunnels all year long. So we needed to have a very large refrigeration plant. So we looked at it, did some designs, and decided sometimes the best thing is just to go out and hire the best expert. And when it came to air conditioning, the Carrier Corporation and its founder, Willis H. Carrier, basically is the father of air conditioning, and he came out and designed for us one of the largest, for the longest time, one of the largest air conditioning systems that was around. And it kind of gave us the ability to run this tunnel closed circuit and create those conditions, including the temperatures from that perspective. And that'll come into play a little bit later as we talk about some of the other facilities. I'm trying to advance a slide and get in that little circle, so I'm glad you guys aren't seeing here. But if I seem like I'm pausing, I'm waiting for the computer to catch up to me. It should at least play the Jeopardy theme or something while it's doing this.